Let us pray. Our Father in heaven, thank you that it's raining and just raining so gently. And thank you for all your other blessings. We're thankful for all that you've done for us long before we were born to make things so good for us now, so that we are able to have such a purity of religion and also such a strong degree of liberty in which to practice it safely. Please help us to learn something of this so that we can praise you and so that we can be wise to know what to do in our own lives. In the name of Jesus, amen. Friends, just a few questions. Five questions. Just so that you can, like, we can be sure that you're getting the gist of things. In what year were the short parliament and long parliament both called? In what year were the short parliament and long parliament called? Second, in 1641, in what country was there a rebellion which alarmed the people of London and which called for an army that Parliament did not trust the king to control? That's kind of a long question, wasn't it? In 1641, in what country was there a rebellion which called for an army that Parliament did not trust the king to control? Question number three. Where did King Charles I go in January of 1642? Now, of course, they would have still been thinking of it as 1641, but to us, January 1642, where the king was not supposed to go, that became a major event in turning the conflict into civil war. Where did King Charles I go, January 1642, where the king was not supposed to go? That became a major event in turning the conflict into civil war. Question number four. According to last week's lecture and this week's reading, what month and year did the English Civil Wars actually begin? I'm not talking about the event from the previous question. According to last lecture and this week's reading, what month and year did the English Civil Wars actually begin? And question number five, what prince, a relative of the king's, was the most famous commander for the royalist armies in the Civil War? What prince, a relative of the king's, was the most famous commander for the royalist armies in the Civil War? All right, what year for the short and long parliaments?
1640.
Mm-hmm. What country was the rebellion, 1641?
Ireland.
Where did the king go? He wasn't supposed to go? It was, if you said Parliament, fine. It was specifically the House of Commons. When did the war actually begin?
August.
Month and year? August. 1642. And what was the name of the Cavalier Prince?
Rupert.
Angie, you were frowning. Did that name have trouble coming to your mind?
Yeah. It came, but then I was partially that came, but then I was unsure if that was the right name or if that was just a name.
Audrey, on the way here, we were talking about how it was hard to get the name Stratford out in correct form, you know, without it becoming Stratford or Stamford or anything. Rupert may be the same way. We now have our official timeline, and I have this deck of playing cards. So let's see. What shall I do with this deck of playing cards? I've got an idea. Each of you can have one suit. Hearts, diamonds, spades, clubs. And you'll draw a card, And whoever's suit is drawn gets to say the next one in line. So, Angie, why don't you draw a card, and then whoever it is says the thing. What suits did I tell you?
Hearts.
Hearts, diamonds, spades, clubs. Is that right?
So do I have to say one and then draw a card, or do I just draw a card and then that person?
Very well, it'll be just like you said. Say one and then draw a card.
Okay.
No. Draw a card, and whatever suit is drawn, that person says it.
G26, Tyndale's Complete New Testament in English is printed.
Is Alvin doing
it? That's right. It doesn't really matter, does it? I guess the next person is supposed to draw. All right. Okay, hearts.
1534, the Act of Supremacy officially separates the Church of England from the Pope.
Yeah. I always feel like cheering for that one. All right, Audrey, let's see what you draw. Well, that's you, right?
I don't know what they are.
Oh, that's spades, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay, 1547, King Edward VI ascends the throne.
Mm-hmm.
1553, Queen Mary I ascends the throne.
Spades, that's you, Audrey.
1558, Queen Elizabeth I ascends the throne.
In 1560, Geneva Bible is published. 1588, Spanish Armada is defeated.
Not me.
You're the next person to draw.
1603, King James I ascends the throne.
1604, in the Hampton Court Conference, King James agrees to a new Bible translation.
1611, Authorized or King James Version is published.
1625, King Charles I ascends the throne.
Alright, you draw.
Oh. 1628, the Petition of Right is passed.
The English Civil War begins.
Congratulations, everybody.
It was hard to remember the order when it was going kind of slowly.
Yeah, exactly. All right, in bold right there is a new date for your official timeline, 1643, the Westminster Assembly convenes. I'll have to admit, that wasn't really all that fun of a timeline card game. We need to come up with something better. The reading assignment. Now, you know that I put this on the internet, so you all can look at this, but I think you should take down the name and author of the article in your notes. Then you wouldn't have to get this link. You could just put it into the internet search engine. The Westminster Assembly of Divines by William Symington. Our textbook doesn't have a chapter on the Westminster Assembly, and it's so important in the religious developments in the English-speaking world that I want you to get a good dose of that. Second Samuel 3:1. Just one verse. Alvin, would you do the honors and read us that aloud, please? 2 Samuel 3:1.
Now there was long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. But David waxed stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul waxed weaker and weaker.
Here's an example of civil war in the Bible in Israel. Okay, friends, the civil war, which is really civil wars, plural, one that was longer, another one that was real brief, but it really was, you know, two, or one with a, you know, an interlude, and then these civil wars are part of the broader, you know, wars in these kingdoms, Scotland and Ireland and England, you know, which go back and include the Bishops' Wars and include the rebellion in Ireland, and so it's a, you know, the broader picture, but the civil war or the civil wars. Interesting that in the history of our republic, we have a war that's often referred to as the Civil War. The dates of our republic's war, that's called the Civil War, from what year to what year? Close? 1861 to 65. And interestingly, in our country's war that's called the Civil War is technically not a civil war. Some of the states seceded, and then there was a war over whether they would be brought back into or whether they were allowed to secede. And so it was not technically a civil war. A civil war is when more than one party is warring to rule over a country. Well, in the English Civil Wars, it truly was civil war. Who is going to rule under what terms? The years of the first Civil War, 1642 to 46. And the war was between King Charles I and his supporters, and the Parliament and their supporters. Now, I'm going to make England and Scotland with my hands. See that? See how that makes a perfect representation of England and Scotland? And the Parliament was, for the most part, powerful in the East and South, London being over here, and the King being powerful in the North and the West. Wales is not over. I don't have a part of my hand for Wales, which is kind of there, or for Cornwall, which sticks out like that. The king powerful in the north and west, the parliament powerful in the east and south, generally speaking. But then there were various cities and castles where it was the other way. the battles, there were several major battles, many minor conflicts and skirmishes. And there were no decisive battles until the end. I guess that makes sense. Once there are decisive battles, then that's the end. But there were conflicts with as many as about 20,000 troops on either side. And several times in those major battles, there was heavy loss of life on both sides. Possibly one of the armies was in possession of the battlefield, the other having had to retreat. But there was no real decisive battle for years. Now, in those battles of those days, there were several times where a city was under siege, kind of small sieges by a comparison with the major sieges in the history of warfare. But there would be a city that was in the hands of those supporting the parliament, and the royalist army would come and try to enter the city and take the arms that they had, and the city would close the gates against them, and the royalist army would besiege them and possibly conquer or possibly not, and the other way around too. So there were sieges at several cities and at some castles. The major battles, the major set piece battles, all went about the same way. The forces at that time consisted of artillery, but the artillery was somewhat primitive and was not utilized decisively, usually. And so the main forces, the main components of the armies were the horse and the foot, is what they called them. The horse meaning the cavalry, the foot meaning the infantry. And the way the forces would be arrayed would be that, here, let's have a battle between the Earl of Ava here and the Duke of Jeff. And we're going to put our infantry in the middle. And then we're going to put one unit of cavalry on the right, one unit of cavalry on the left, and another unit of cavalry on the right. And we'll put our artillery here, but we don't have very many pieces, and we can't work them real well, and the ordnance is not that effective, and so it's just not going to play all that big a role. So here's our battle. Now, over here, we have the forces of the king and Prince Alvin is in command of the infantry in the center, and the Duke of Anjou is in command of a unit of cavalry, and the Earl of Audrey has cavalry on the other side. Now, there is how the battles were waged in the English Civil War. So, Prince Rupert would charge with his cavalry and run off the parliamentary cavalry. They would be dispersed, and Prince Rupert would keep going, and he'd be after them and go back and try to take the baggage from the camp and stuff like that. And then the infantry would go toward each other, and they'd be fighting hand to hand with pikes. They would shoot their, you know, they had firearms, but they were primitive. It was more or less shoot one shot, and it might go off or might not, and by that time, you're within distance of blows being struck with pikes and things like that. And then, Oliver Cromwell would be in command of cavalry, and he would defeat the Royalist cavalry, but had his cavalry better trained under better discipline than Prince Rupert's did. And so, just about the time the Royalist infantry were defeating the Parliamentarian infantry, Oliver Cromwell, rather than chasing the enemy cavalry off that way, would come and attack the Royalist infantry from behind, causing them to be scattered and have to retreat. Now, I gave a very vague description of how one of the battles went, but that was a lot of how things went in the English Civil War. Here, like, let me give everybody's cavalry and infantry back. Okay. This was a terrible thing to have happen to a country. People fighting against their own countrymen, in some cases their own family members. 1642 to 1646, all over England, the First Civil War. Now, in London, there was no actual warfare. London was and is a very big city, and in the actual city of London, there was no warfare. And so, although there were a number of hardships and there was threats all the time, there was a relatively good situation for religion in the giant city of London. During the very time of the Civil War, the Baptist movement really got going in London. Now, I'll tell you a history that is the history I learned. However, this history is not universally accepted. There is a history derived from a document called the Kiffin Manuscript. Kiffin, K-I-F-F-I-N, from the possibility that it was written by him. And I started to tell you some of that story before from the JLJ Church. We got right up to January of 1642, or to them, 1641. And so right the same time that the conflict between Parliament and the King became so acute, when the King tried to arrest the five members by coming to the Houses of Parliament. According to the Kiffin Manuscript, in January of what to us is 1652, two of the groups went down to the river together, and the man who had been to Holland, Blount, B-L-U-N-T, or B-L-O-U-N-T, presumably having already been baptized there, baptized a Bible teacher in the church named Blacklock, and the two of them baptized the rest of the congregation, 40-something one day, several others soon after, for a total of 53 people baptized. Now, I'm nothing like a qualified enough or good enough historian in these matters to make my own judgments about the different documents. I was taught that, but I've also read people who reject the Kippen manuscript. And so I'm telling you that as, you know, according to one source. And if that is better established than I realize, you know, I'm glad I don't want to be saying things I'm not sure of. But here is something that I am sure of. During the Civil War, the Baptists were able to operate publicly, whereas before that, they and others like them had to operate more or less in secret. But during the Civil War, the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Laud, as you know, had been arrested and had been executed. And the king was not there. His people were not there. The Bishop of London was not in power. And so the Baptists were able to print and distribute literature publicly. They were able to meet openly, and there was nobody to persecute them. There were people who were criticizing them, but no one with actually the power to persecute them. I think it'd be easy for you all to grasp that kind of taste of liberty that was experienced there by the Baptists and others was something that people really enjoyed. And later, when that was, when religious dissenters were clamped down on again, it was something that the nation couldn't really get used to and go back to. It was kind of like after Queen Mary did what she did the few years that she was in power. After she died, the country, generally speaking, didn't want to go back to that. Didn't want to go back to when if you're not the same religion as the monarch, you get burned to death all the time. So the public spread of the Baptist congregations in London coincided with the Long Parliament and the Civil War. So while the Baptists were not being actively persecuted by anybody with the power to burn them at the stake or anything, their congregations, and more and more congregations became baptized, were out of step with the prevailing religion in London. The Presbyterians and the Independent Congregationalists were both baby-sprinkling groups. But there was also pressure for everyone allied with Parliament against the king to all be tolerant of each other for the sake of the war effort. So it's an important period in the history of religion and of religious liberty that the Baptist movement could spread and prosper publicly during that during the Civil War. Okay, so the Civil War started August 1642. Now let's move into 1643. 1643. Parliament passed an ordinance authorizing the Westminster Assembly. And only about a month later, the Westminster Assembly actually convened. Now, I want our next class session to be all about the Westminster Assembly. The reading the judges assigned you is about the Westminster Assembly. So I'm not going to say very much about it right now. Just that it was in the summer of 1643, the Westminster Assembly convened by order of Parliament. Remember that Parliament had proposed this to the king, but the king wouldn't allow it. But with the king gone, Parliament did it, and the Westminster Assembly convened. Because it was done without the approval of the king and against his wishes, some important theologians then weren't part of the Westminster Assembly, most notably James Usher. Upon whose work the Westminster Confession was based and who would have been a wonderful part of that, but he considered it illegal and wouldn't attend. Now, in 1643, there was the recognition by Parliament that they needed allies in the war against the king. The battles had been indecisive. The king's forces were still strong and in the field. He was still in control of a lot of the country. And they made an agreement with the Scots. They made an agreement called the Solemn League and Covenant. This is in 1643, August through September of 1643. Now, we've already had the National Covenant. That was just Scottish. Did not involve the English. National Covenant. Remember when Archbishop Laud and the king tried to instill the new prayer book and Scotland revolted and that was the start of the Bishops' Wars and all of that. That's the National Covenant. This is something else. The Solemn League and Covenant. It was agreed to by the Scottish Kirk or Church and agreed to by the English Parliament and agreed to by the Westminster Assembly. For their part, the Scots agreed to support Parliament in the Civil War, to come in with their military, their army, on the side of Parliament. Parliament, for their part, and the Westminster Assembly agreed to reform the government of the church in England and Ireland, quote, according to the word of God, unquote. It was to be an agreement that the Parliament and the Westminster Assembly would reform the Church of England and Church of Ireland away from the episcopal government or prelacy into something like a Presbyterian system like the Scots already had. It was, on the part of the Scots, part of their effort to maintain their self-governing church structure that they had that was being threatened by the king and the Church of England system. If they can have the Church of England be restructured as Presbyterian, then there won't be Church of England archbishops trying to get them back to an episcopal system. A very important development in the Civil War, the Scots coming in on the part of Parliament. 1644. In this interesting situation in the giant city of London, where there are Baptist churches, but there are only a few, and they're small, and they are a very small minority, there's no official persecution by the king or the archbishop or anything. There was unofficial persecution in the form of criticism. The Baptists were being accused of being the same thing as the Anabaptists from Germany from 100 years before. This whole story has to be told with a little bit of information about the Anabaptist takeover of the city of Munster about 100 years before this. There was an Anabaptist group that managed to become the predominant group in the city of Munster in Germany. I don't know what German kingdom it was. And they advocated not only baptism of people who could profess faith, but also a number of ungodly, unbiblical ideas which they preached and practiced. And it was so out of step with normal life that the civil authorities finally had to raise an army and conquer the city of Munster and throw the Anabaptists out of power. That tumultuous event gave a very bad name to the Anabaptists. And people who were against the Anabaptist position, then, either in good conscience or not, used that as a way to criticize the Anabaptists very strongly and make people very alarmed at the idea of Anabaptists being in London. It was already a very tumultuous time in London. You know, the king was out, Parliament was in control. It was a very strange kind of revolutionary time in London, so that people could say, watch out, there are Anabaptists in London like there were in, you know, Munster. And that could raise alarm at people. The Baptist churches then found that they needed to explain themselves, to defend themselves, to where they could say, we are not the same thing as the Anabaptists of Munster. So they published a confession of faith. This is what the Reformed people had been doing all during the Reformation. If they're being accused of all kinds of things that aren't true, they publish a confession to explain what they actually believe. You know, this was done by the Lutherans when they presented the Holy Roman Emperor with the Augsburg Confession. You know, whatever might be said about us, here's what we actually believe and do. And so the first London Confession of Baptist Faith was published 1644 by 7 baptized congregations. The first London Confession of Baptist Faith. It was then revised in 1646 and again in 1651, but first put forth in 1644. And this, again, is for us something we can look back to with a lot of thankfulness to God, that the Baptist movement was getting underway so strongly, or was so publicly acknowledged in London, that we can be thankful that the confession was so good. It's orthodox, it's not weird, and that it was effective. And that can be the way, ever since then, in the English-speaking world, if there are groups being slandered, well, then the pattern has been set and has been followed many times. Well, we're going to publish what we actually believe. And it's going to be orthodox according to going all the way back to the New Testament and back to the ecumenical councils, and it's going to agree 95% with all orthodox groups, but we're going to show at what points we believe the Bible means something slightly different from what you have said about church government or about baptism. The first London Confession of Baptist Faith. 1645. I'm telling you about approximately one or two things from each year, all during a civil war. You're not getting the whole story, but you read some of it. You got a pretty good article of it in the chapter you read in your book. 1645, Oliver Cromwell was the driving force in the formation of the New Model Army. You often see that as NMA, the New Model Army, established January of 1645. Here are some of the features of it. Whereas the parliamentary forces in previous years had been primarily just the militia, you know, the people called out to come out and temporarily take up arms if war was in their vicinity, now it is professional soldiers, men who have enlisted and are being paid, and it's expected they're going to be training and serving in the army for the duration of the war. The New Model Army is going to be primarily, or made up mostly of, professional soldiers rather than militia. And its officers at every level are going to be men who have been promoted by merit. You know, they've done well, they've shown good leadership qualities, they've succeeded, and so they are promoted regardless of class. It's not that the nobility will immediately be named colonel and general. It's that no matter what the person's class background, he'll be promoted in the army or not, by merit. It was predominantly Puritan in religion, and religion was a big part of the life of the New Model Army. Oliver Cromwell himself was independent Congregationalist. Within the army, he made sure that there was toleration of Presbyterianism and independent Congregationalism and whatever other separatist group there was. I'm not sure of that last part. I'm not sure whatever group there was, but the major separatist groups he was tolerant of in the army. And the New Model Army won 2 major victories in the campaigning season of 1645. Major decisive victories. And the New Model Army, for all practical purposes, won the war in the summer of 1645. The New Model Army wore uniforms across the whole army. And the uniforms were dyed to a matching color with the dye that was the cheapest. Their uniforms were made all one color, the cheapest color, which was red. And so the red coats were born. British Army wore primarily red uniforms for the next couple of centuries. Turn the calendar to 1646. 1646. King Charles I's forces were completely defeated, and King Charles I snuck away disguised as a servant. The person helping him, disguised as a Puritan parliamentarian, and they passed through the parliamentarian army lines and made it to the Scots, and King Charles I surrendered himself to the Scots rather than surrendering to Parliament. And negotiations ensued. Negotiations which basically were going to have to be agreed on by too many parties. The Scottish Army, Scottish Parliament, Scottish Kirk, Parliamentarian Army, Parliament. And so negotiations failed to establish a settlement. The king basically wouldn't accept any terms that were offered by part of the Parliamentarian Army or Parliament, nor would they grant the terms he was calling for. Eventually, turn the calendar to 1647, eventually in 1647, the Scots turned the king over to the English. And whether he was allowed to or not, King Charles I escaped arrest in 1647. And right near the end of 1647, King Charles I, which remember, he's also King of Scotland, he agreed with the Scots for their support to reinstate him. And again, what they demanded of him, and he agreed to, was installing Presbyterianism in the Church of England. He agreed that he would install Presbyterianism in the Church of England in return for their support in reinstating him, putting him back on the throne in London. That was at the very, that was in December 1647. So, in early 1648, the Civil War started up again. There were royalist uprisings in several places around England. And then the Scots led an army against the Parliamentarian New Model Army. But in August of 1648, Oliver Cromwell and the New Model Army had an overwhelming, decisive victory over the Scottish Royalist Army at Preston, the Battle of Preston. And so the Second Civil War lasted only that long. Just really the campaigning season of 1648. So continuing in 1648, what year did the First Civil War get going? 1642. And what year did the first round of Civil War end? 1646. And what year was this second round of Civil War? 1648. So still in 1648, the king was now in custody of the Parliamentary Army, and there were forces in the army that wanted King Charles I executed. There was a prevailing opinion in the army that the king could not be trusted. He was going to continue to fight against Parliament no matter what happened. That he would call for foreign support, even Irish, even Roman Catholic if he had to. that was the prevailing opinion. So there was a strong mindset in the army that he just had to be killed. In Parliament, an agreement could not be reached for the king to be executed. Parliament, in the end of 1648, was still not able to reach an agreement. So an army officer named Pride, Colonel Pride. I don't have his first name. Do you have his first name handy? Colonel Pride took a detachment of soldiers, and when it was time for Parliament to come back into their house, he wouldn't allow a lot of them to come in. Whatever members were against proceedings of treason against the king were not allowed in. This event has come to be called Pride's Purge. He purged the Parliament of all members who were not for proceeding against the king. And that Parliament then has come to be known to history as the Rump Parliament. It's technically still the Long Parliament, but it's now only part of it acting as for the whole. And there, in December and January of 1648, or by our reckoning, going into January of 1649. King Charles was accused of, tried for, convicted of treason. And January 30th, 1649, King Charles I was executed by beheading.
What was the date again?
January 30th, by our reckoning, 1649, although for them it's still 1648. January 30th, 1649, King Charles I was executed for treason. By order of Parliament, but only the Rump Parliament left after Pride's Purge. So there was plenty of room, of course, for people to say that it was illegal. So, still in 1648 by their reckoning, but to us, February of 1649. The House of Commons voted that the monarchy was no more. They voted that there was no more monarch. And they voted out the House of Lords. The House of Commons voted out of existence the House of Lords. So all that was left of the government that used to be the monarch and the House of Commons and the House of Lords was now just the House of Commons, and then declared that their government was now a republic. And they referred to the country now as the Commonwealth of England. Out of the House of Commons, 45 members were chosen to form a council called the Council of State to rule the country. These last few events I'm talking to you about are February 1649. Or to them, still 1648. Now, you remember that Ireland was in a state of revolt against English rule starting back in 16... 41. Remember that, you know, alarmed London, and there needed to be an army, but the Parliament wouldn't trust the king with it, and vice versa. Ireland had been in revolt since 1641. There had been some sort of agreement with the king a few years before, but essentially Ireland was still in rebellion against English rule, and now there was no king. And so there was definitely the question of whether Ireland was ruled by England or not. England sent an army under Oliver Cromwell to Ireland. And there was lots of violence in the year 1649 and following as the English, in effect, reconquered Northern Ireland. It is this episode for which a lot of the present-day condemnation of Oliver Cromwell is based. Oliver Cromwell is despised, is a despised, hated historical figure by a lot of people, especially in Ireland, or people of Irish descent. It's not in dispute that there was lots of violence, lots of killing in the Reconquest of Ireland campaign under Cromwell and others. To what extent Cromwell is at fault, or to what extent he is justified in that, of course people have different opinions. Then Oliver Cromwell also went and warred against the Scots, because King Charles's son, who would later be reinstated as King Charles II, was with the Scots, and the Scots were trying to get him enthroned in England by force, but Oliver Cromwell soundly defeated the Scottish army that was supporting Charles II. So that by the end of 1651, things were more or less settled for a while. Oliver Cromwell and the New Model Army basically having defeated everybody, having defeated the Irish and the Scottish and the English royalists. So there you go, friends, a very brief sketch of the English Civil Wars, or the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, at the beginning of which Oliver Cromwell was an obscure member of Parliament from Cambridge, and an effective cavalry leader of small units, at the end of which he was ruling over England and Ireland and Scotland, more or less. So as to religious liberty, the imposition by the king and the archbishop of an Arminian, theologically Arminian, governmentally episcopal rule over the Presbyterian Reformed Church in Scotland was successfully resisted. Separatist churches like Baptist grew and published and spread. Toleration of dissenting religious groups was widely practiced. I think the taste among the English-speaking people for religious liberty and an end to Roman Catholic and Church of England strong-arm persecution of imposing religion, I think, taste for the freedom from that got on the tongues of the people that would eventually lead to the way things are now. That's all we have time for today, friends. Thanks for listening to what I had to say.